Welcome to the second lecture on black hole thermodynamics. The way I'll talk about this stuff today is I'll recap from last time what Todd talked about. He should be here, but yeah, he's not. Then I'll give some examples about what we get from those laws. And I'll say the last law that he kind of omitted. Is not very useful, not very important. This is just for sake of completeness. And I'll have a small interlude. Yeah, Todd is here. I'll have a small interlude on how to calculate temperatures fast for most types of black holes. And then I'll talk a bit about the important bit, which is how quantum mechanics changes the thermodynamic black hole. Thermodynamic laws for black holes. So I think I can start. So recap. I think I'm always standing in front of what I'm writing. So if you can't see what I'm writing, then tell me. So I'll just recap what the three laws were. So the zeroth law is that the surface gravity kappa, so temperature, hence T, is constant on the horizon. Of stationary black hole. And basically this is what it says. So what it means is that they are in thermal equilibrium. And that's all I'm going to say about it because Todd talked about it last time. First law, dE, and this is going to be probably very boring, but it will be a bit useful for us later. So that's why I want to have it on board. dQ plus. I'm going to add one more term that Todd didn't write down last time, but this is just for sake of interest, plus P dV. So we're just saying that change in energy is that's completely rubbish. plus omega dj. So change in energy is a change in rotational energy plus change in electrostatic energy plus heat exchange and mechanical work. And this Todd didn't write down last time because this isn't there for black holes. It's for black brains. I'm not going to elaborate on this. This is just for interest if you want to look into it. And this is the term you also have to include. And second law is A dot is greater or equal to zero. So maybe a bit more since entropy is area over 4, h bar g. So it's basically restating the usual second law of thermodynamics that entropy always increases. So area increases in time. And this is how I think this is the more or less the definition that Todd gave last time. I'm going to generalize or restate the second law for something that might be a bit more useful. So this is what I'll call a generalized second law, and it's due to Bekenstein. Yeah, and if you have any questions during the talk, don't hesitate to ask me. I'm not bothered by interrupting. Generalized second law of VH thermodynamics. So I'll just call it GSL for later. So the way we will write it is, say we have a total entropy, which is entropy of everything we usually think about when we think about entropy. So I'll call it entropy of usual, plus some constant that we'll have to fix later on, A over H bar. So this is Hawking Bekenstein entropy. And what this version of the generalized second law says is that delta S total is greater or equal to zero. And this number we're going to fix by going to the last bit of our talk, by using Hawking radiation. And Anton has a first question.
Is that an X or a zeta?
Zeta. You can call it psi. This is some symbol.
Okay.
This is going to be 1/4. So you can spoil yourself and then put 1/4 here already, or you can wait till the climax of the talk. Sorry?
What is S usual?
It's the entropy of everything.
But it's a black hole.
No. So this is entropy for the whole system.
Oh, I see.
So this is going to be entropy of, for example, some I don't know, scalar field close to the black hole or whatever. Or an example of a box, which I'll be talking about in a second. Which Todd mentioned, some part of it how Todd may be mentioned in the last talk. This is not many words, but this is a very useful statement of it. And actually, it will turn out that there is something fiddly with this statement of the second law. And we're going to try to fix it by using the quantum black hole thermodynamics. So really what this is equivalent to is saying that there is no perpetuum mobilis, or however you call it, perpetual motion machines, because otherwise, I mean, you could gain energy by doing nothing. So, yeah, this is just a recap and a slight restatement of the thermodynamics laws. And I'll go to the more interesting part of it. Just apply these laws to some maybe interesting examples. So one example is going to be the statement that area is non-decreasing. Limit on efficiency of energy conversion in black hole collisions. I'm not going to do any dynamic collisions here, but I can still talk about it a bit. So I'll draw a, maybe this is not enough space, so I'll draw it here. A Finkelstein diagram of coalescing two black holes. This is going to a black hole of mass M3. And say the, it's an ugly draw. So say this is M1, M2. There's some gravitational radiation. Going out at the merging point. So this is going to carry away some energy E. And E is going to be M1 plus M2 minus M3. So with this definition of energy carried out, the efficiency of energy conversion, so all right, I'll call it eta, like the usual eta in thermodynamics. M1 plus M2 minus M3 over M1 plus M2. Yeah. So say initially we have these two black holes. And they're in approximately stationary. So when I say approximately stationary, what I mean is that A1 is going to be 16 pi m1 squared. A2 is 16 pi m2 squared. And what the area theorem tells us is that A3, so implies A3 is greater or equal to 16 pi m1 squared plus m2 squared. Now I have to say there's not going to be any really fancy mathematics in this talk. You might be disappointed. I think last time I overdid it, so this time I might underdo it. So say, you know, we know that, you know, this black hole is not going to be in equilibrium initially. But until it's in equilibrium, we're going to have that 16 pi m3 squared is going to be greater or equal than a3. And the equality is going to hold when it's going to become stationary. So this implies that M3 is greater or equal than maybe I should write something here. Until equilibrium. So M3 is greater or equal than square root of M1 squared plus M2 squared. So we're getting that eta is less or equal than 1 minus m1 squared plus m2 squared or M1 plus M2, which is less than equal 1 minus 1 over the square root of 2. So this radiated energy could be used for work. And what we got here is basically, you know, a statement about how much useful energy you can extract out of this kind of system. And this is very similar to the usual talk in thermodynamics where you talk about the efficiency of engines. This is not a Carnot engine, but...
Does the second law, is that second law valid for black hole mergers?
It should be. That's the point that, I mean, this is going to apply to nearly stationary black holes. So I'm that's what I'm assuming, that these are stationary at first. And then it should apply. And yeah, this is one example. Also, an interesting example is bifurcation of black holes. Or more specifically, the fact that bifurcation of a black hole is not allowed. This is going to be even simpler mathematics. Because say we had M3 goes to M1 plus M2. And assume that both M1 and M2 are greater than zero. I think it's a reasonable assumption for splitting of black holes. Then we have that M3 is less or equal than M1 squared plus M2 squared. I'm again using the same theorem, which is less or equal than, less than M1 plus M2. So we have this. OK. But then there's also energy conservation. Which tells us that M3 is greater or equal than M1 plus M2. Contradiction. Yeah, so using this very simple mathematics, you can prove that black holes don't split. I think there's some more fancy ways of doing this, but this is quite satisfying. Yeah?
So when you write M3 is greater than or equal to M1 plus M2, you're assuming that nobody's doing something. There's some sort of radiation coming in.
Yeah, so I'm assuming that bifurcation is with something that just happens
spontaneously.
But this, and obviously, if you added lots of energy to a system, that I could see maybe this happening. But this is assuming that you have a black hole that's stationary and, you know, it's splitting.
But it doesn't rule out that, you know, you could just zap it with a laser or something and split it apart. At least this proof, I guess, doesn't.
Yeah, I mean, this proof doesn't take that into account. So I'm assuming that if you had a laser strong enough, then maybe you could split the black hole.
Laser.
laser is not a good say. I mean, if you were able to put some energy into the black hole. No, I don't think that's possible.
Some sort of radiation.
Because if a black hole is stationary, you put some mass into it, I mean, it's going to be non-stationary for a rather short time. So unless you put really, I don't know.
Yeah, I guess if you put a big mass next to the black hole, you can make some kind of...
Yeah, I've seen some numerical simulations of like binary black hole systems and so on, and merging. But I mean, and this can, you always get merging. Because if you have big enough energy, that will be big enough mass, and you will have merging. But I've never seen an example of black hole splitting. I don't know. Maybe you can come up with an example, but I don't think that's possible. At least in classical case. I mean, I could see tunneling occurring in a very, very improbable tunneling where a black hole splits. But classically, that's not allowed. So this is going to be a bit more relevant now for showing that there's something seemingly wrong with the generalized second law, which is I'll call box lowering. And the basic setup is, I mean, the mathematics was introduced by Todd last time. So you have some geodesic, and particles will have conserved energy, which will be m x dot mu psi mu, where psi is a time-like killing vector. So so if we fix r theta phi, I'm working in four dimensions throughout the whole talk. But it doesn't really matter. So if we have, if we fix r theta and phi, then the velocity is x dot mu equals psi mu over psi. And from this follows that the energy is psi m. So now, so suppose now that we have some box, and we have a black hole and a box, and you want to lower it onto the horizon. And the black hole is that thing. So suppose you lower this box quasi-statically onto the horizon. And what this gives you is that you will be able to extract rest mass energy, because E, as the distance of the box from the horizon, or from the black hole, is infinite, is m. And as it goes to the Schwarzschild radius, is going to go zero. And we know that because this time-like killing vector on the horizon is going to become null. That's full. It's going to change directions. So it's going to be space-like inside the horizon. So this length is going to be zero. So if you did it quasi-statically, you would be able to extract the rest mass energy. And this somehow, you know, we've extracted energy out of the system like for free. I mean, assuming that you could do this, which would be a bit difficult. And why it does that is, assume that you have some, yeah?
But wouldn't it be like if it has potential energy now?
Yeah, but so, you had energy, and you lower it, and you drop it on the horizon, and leave it on the horizon. You gain the extra energy that you had from lowering it, because you have this difference of Fine.
But how can you extract the energy in this way?
You just drop the box. You stand somewhere close to the black hole and drop it.
Like if it was on like a crank, right? You would drop it, and then a crank would turn for you. So that it's just like.
Yeah. So the way you can see that this is making some problems for the generalized second law is that suppose this was some box of entropy. So you have some entropy in the box, and if you let go when it reaches the horizon, so when it reaches the horizon, you will have change in area 0 according for the black hole from the first law, if it's quasi static, it's the static law. And you're going to get energy for free. So something is wrong. But this you can resolve in two ways. And they're a bit naive, but I mean, you look at the total entropy, and you notice that the Hawking-Bekenstein term goes as 1 over h bar. So at the classical level and classical limit, the Hawking-Bekenstein entropy is going to infinity. So, even if you have an infinitesimal change in area, it will still lead to a finite change in entropy. So you can somehow see that it probably works. But this is the first time we see that, yeah, so something maybe doesn't work at the classical level with thermodynamics. So there are actually a few more problems at the classical level, and we'll all try to fix them in this kind of manner. So classically, black holes don't radiate. So we would guess that we have zero and zero temperature. You can again understand this because the Bekenstein-Hawking temperature is h bar kappa over 8 pi zeta. And it also goes to 0 as h bar goes to 0. So on the classical level, black holes don't have temperature. And classically, we have that the area is not decreasing, but the generalized second law says that. So suppose you have more black holes, and what the area theorem says is that the area is non-decreasing for each black hole, for each and every. But this generalized second law just says that only the total change in entropy has to be greater than or equal to 0. So we would guess that you could have an area decreasing and still and getting some entropy in some different way for the total entropy to still increase. So in some very strange way, we have that this kind of writing of entropy doesn't, there's something wrong with this. And I mean, this might not be very convincing the way I'm saying this, but we'll see that actually when we include quantum effects, the area can be decreasing, and really the only thing that's important is that the total entropy is non-decreasing. So at the classical level, black hole thermodynamics is not exactly the same as ordinary thermodynamics. Was very close. It's just some apparent things that you could fix. We'll write here. And with this, it works as simple examples and something wrong with the laws. I'll just take the third law for completeness. So the statement will be temperature cannot be taken to zero in a finite number of steps. So this is often misinterpreted as that the entropy at zero is zero, but this is actually not the case. And the reason for that is that we know of a few examples where this isn't the case. For instance, if we have supersymmetry and we have some large ground state degeneracies, which are proportional in some way to E to Q to alpha, where Q is charge, alpha is some power, then the entropy at zero temperature is going to go like, it's going to be exactly the logarithm of the number of degeneracies. Is going to go like Q alpha. So we notice that these statements are not correct, not the same. So in a way, this is what many people say, that the third law of thermodynamics is in many statements not correct. And this is an example, a different example of an extremely Reisner Nordstrom black hole, which I'm led to believe is quite important for some string theorists. Not that I would know. But if we have a non-extremal Reisner-Nordstrom black hole, then you can show, and I'm not going to derive it, but if you ask me, I can derive it after the lecture, unless you really want to see it. A equals, and it might take me some time, so I wouldn't like to do it live, 2m m plus mu minus q squared. where mu is. And I have to apologize because many times in the talk, I'll be missing the factors of g and h, but I'll be putting them in and out so that when I'll need h bar and g, I'll keep them there. If I don't need them, I don't. But obviously, there's a g squared here. Yeah. And kappa is 4 pi mu over a. So for a non-extremal black hole, you have q is less than m. So how would we go about making this black hole extremal? So for those who don't know what an extremal black hole is, it's a black hole that will have q equals to m, and at the same time, zero temperature. I think a better definition of an extremal black hole is a black hole that doesn't have temperature. Because some time ago, well, like 10 years ago, people often misunderstood what extremal black holes were. For example, a BPS black hole was often interpreted as an extremal one. And that's actually not the case. So supersymmetric black holes are not the same as extremal black holes. Although every extremal black hole is supersymmetric. It's just that not every supersymmetric solution will be an extremal solution. If someone is confused, then I see that Rob is confused. Maybe
the other way around.
Probably. Maybe I said it wrong.
I mean, if it's supersymmetric, I would hope that the temperature is zero.
Yeah.
So it's extremal. But I can build extremal black holes that aren't necessarily.
I should have said it better. So say we want to make it extremal. So the way we will do it is take not a laser, but a big cannon and start shooting at the black hole with some charged particles. And basically add some mass, add some charge in such a way that we would get m plus some small m equal to q plus some small q. Now I'm assuming that these are positive. Substitute everything for absolute values. I realize that this is not very visible. Okay, so we add M and Q, and the thing is, if we want this matter to fall into the black hole, then we will want somehow the gravitational force to be more important than the electrostatic force. So what we will want.
I have to backtrack, but what is GS?
Ground state.
Ground
state. So if we want the matter to fall in freely, then what we require is that mm is greater than qq. And this is something that a high schooler could do. So I'm keeping to my true self, and I'm not doing any difficult stuff. And this, together with the fact that q is less than m, means that q plus q is less than m plus m. And I'm assuming these masses are small, so we're adding matter in many steps. So what this means is that it would take an infinitely long time to make it extremal. So this allows us to, and I know this is one example, so this will be a brave statement, but we can restate the third law as extremal black holes are not natural. A very simple statement. And this is the case, at least in terms of the black holes we've observed so far. There are certain black holes that need extremality for the rotating black holes. But it's a very good guess that there's no extremal black holes. So, with this, I'll have a small interlude from thermodynamics. Oh, this will be related, but how to calculate temperature fast.
Andrew,
yeah.
Like, this not naturality that you said of extremal black holes. I mean, this not naturality. I mean, what? It's also that they have a naked singularity, right? It wouldn't be.
No. They don't have a naked singularity. For example, this is. I'll write it. I can use the side word for this. You know that for a Reisner and Nordstrom, you have 1 minus 2 g m over r minus q squared over r squared in 4 dimensions. Yeah.
But your timeline killing is always timeline.
He wants to say that you have 2 radii, and extremal means that 2 radii are equal to each other.
Yeah.
It's
but
not
you.
The radius is 0, but it's the
yeah, yeah, yeah. No, I know,
yeah.
I know.
But that doesn't mean that there is a naked singularity.
Yeah, okay, but I mean, if you see the 2 radius, it's when the 2 radius get together, that your time-like feeling vector is always time-like.
Yeah.
So doesn't mean that it's a naked singularity?
No.
Well, it goes null at one point, and then it becomes time-like. So there is a horizon. It's just that the horizon, well, we're going to see a calculation of temperature, and that temperature has gone to 0.
Yeah.
I mean, it won't be a very explicit calculation. I'll just say how to do it. And this will have a little bit more mathematics. And I'll say something, and then you can ask me to give an explicit example, and I can calculate, for example, the temperature of a rising nostrum, if it's not clear. So, and I'll say this, that this is based on something that doesn't work, but gives the right results.
And what about it doesn't work?
I mean, it's based on Euclidean quantum gravity, and it's known that it doesn't work.
Okay.
But it gives correct results, so at least for calculating black hole temperatures. And this is something that Hawking did in 1975. So suppose we have a metric for a black hole, and this will be a very simple one. I mean, this in general works better. The squared minus f d t squared plus dr squared. you can do this. It's not so simple for rotating black holes, but I think you can still do this. I have to say I've never done the calculation for rotating black holes. So F is a Lekkonen factor. And this is one example. I'm getting hot, so I'll take this off. So suppose you have a metric like that, and yeah, I should speed up. So we'll look at the near horizon geometry of this black hole. So say R plus is the largest solution to F equals zero. So basically it's just the horizon and the outermost horizon. Then if we look at R equals R plus epsilon squared, then up to order of epsilon squared, and then we let epsilon go to zero at the end of the calculation. F, this is a bar, equals F of R plus, which is zero, plus F prime of R plus epsilon squared. And dr squared equals 4 epsilon squared d epsilon squared. So now we can rewrite the metric, and So we plug this in into the metric. We have ds squared goes to, this is near horizon. Four over F prime of R plus d epsilon squared minus F prime of R plus squared over 4 epsilon squared d d squared plus R plus squared. So what we'll do now is a wake rotation. So we'll let tau be imaginary time, and in this bracket now, this gets a plus sign. And we recognize that it looks like a metric for a circle if t, or if tau is periodic. Then we would have this being the radius of the circle. So say if tau periodic, Now, recall.
Minor remark, you probably mean it's like a plane instead of a circle, right?
Sorry?
You mean that it's like two dimensional flat plane?
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah.
Not a circle.
Okay, yeah. But I was thinking of like somehow periodicity, so for me.
Oh, you mean that tau is like a coordinate system?
Yeah.
Yeah,
yeah. So recall that canonical ensemble partition function is Z equals trace E minus H over D. So, where E minus H over D propagates the system with imaginary time. So what this means is that thermal equilibrium is equivalent to periodic Euclidean time with period 1 over t. So, in our case, this means that temperature is just F prime bar plus over 4 pi. So you give me a metric, a very difficult metric. I won't be able to give you the temperature so easily. It'll take some time. But you can always use this trick. And this trick really follows from writing a path integral and for Euclidean gravity, and realizing that this goes like the beta. So, I mean, we could reintroduce the h bar factors here as well. So, if you'll be interested, I can derive something for you, but obviously, this is a very simple prescription for finding temperatures of not too complicated black holes. And I have to say, I don't know where this fails. I feel that this will fail at some point, because this is based on something that is just an analogy in some way.
I'm not sure what you mean by fail.
I mean, I could imagine that there will be some special case of some black hole that wouldn't follow this rule. Maybe not a black hole, but some kind of... I mean, if I couldn't make it periodic so easily, then it would be different for me.
Right.
But I've never seen an example, so I'm just covering my bases that someone gives me
okay.
A counterexample. And but I think it, in most cases, I mean, it works. It's based on something that doesn't work, but this you can calculate it.
Well, I think when you say it doesn't work, what you mean is no one's ever managed to carry the program of Euclidean quantum gravity to a completion. I think it's also true that if implicitly here what you're saying is that the horizon is a there's a killing horizon. There's a killing vector that's associated with the generators of the horizon. And in some sense, this is a quick way to calculate the surface gravity or surface gravity over 2 pi. I mean, that's what, but if you, I think if you have a killing, no, okay, I take that back, yeah. If you have a rotating black hole,
yeah,
you're allowed to get confused in this procedure.
So, I mean, I was thinking of, when I was doing this, I was thinking of the Kerr black hole. Even that Kerr black hole is not so difficult, but if I took the Myers-Petty solution, I would have problems with deriving the temperature there.
Well, the yeah.
So, with this, this is not much space, but I'll start bigger topic. And if you have any more questions about this, I mean, I can talk a bit more about black holes later on. I'm not saying I'm going quite a bit faster than I was planning on. So maybe I flipped something. Quantum black hole thermodynamics. I have more pages than I thought. So, main result in this kind of section of the talk, the last section, is going to be Hawking radiation. And I have to say, it might not be very satisfying because I'll do the undo effect and then I'll just use equivalence principle to get Hawking radiation. I don't know how to do it otherwise, but I'm pretty sure that there is some better way. So what it says is black hole radiates like black body with temperature equal to h bar k over 2 pi. So this is the statement of theorem. I don't know. So before we explore any details behind it, I'm going to discuss a few facts that follow from this. First of all, it fixes the constant psi, for zeta, to be 1/4. Second, this allows areas of black holes decrease. So kind of fixes the second law. And also fix is our own physical example of the box lowering. And this I'll talk a little bit more in detail. Maybe you don't find the box lowering is a little bit more interesting, and I'm just going back to it. But box lowering. So this is going to be based on a conjecture, which I'm not going to prove. It's kind of implicit and not very important. We are not going to use it, really. It's just behind it that entropy of box with linear size size R satisfies that the entropy is less or equal to 2 pi E R, and E will be the energy. So suppose again that we have the box again near the event horizon here, and so maybe I'll just throw it. We have a box, and there's a temperature on top of the box, which is T1. Temperature on the bottom of the box, which is T2. And they're going to satisfy T2 over T1 equals GTT of R1 over from which follows that T2 is less than T1. So if we have this, the fact that we have different temperatures will create some kind of a buoyancy force, which will be proportional to this kind of displaced radiation that will be related to this. And there is going to be some distance for this box I'll call this distance a critical distance, will be greater than the working for a Schwarzschild black hole, greater than the horizon, for which energy of displaced radiation is equal to energy of the box at R critical. So if we lower the box to R critical and then drop it, then this means that the exchange in Bekenstein-Hawking entropy is going to be E over EPH. But S box is going to be, the entropy for the box is going to be less equal than entropy for the displaced radiation. Which actually is equal to EdBH. And in this way we've,
well, you finish your sentence.
Okay. And in this way we kind of fix the problem with the second law. Yeah?
So where does it, is the buoyancy force from the walking radiation?
Yeah, I mean the fact that now the black holes are, the black hole has a temperature and so on. And there will be different temperatures for the box. I mean, the box, the top part of the box is going to have a different temperature than the lower part of the box. So this is going to create some kind of buoyancy force.
Is it in contact with the black hole?
Not yet. I mean, it's not sitting on the black hole, but it's with, I mean, it's exchanging thermal radiation. I mean, the black hole is thermally radiating.
Why would it be at a different temperature?
Just the normal temperature
gradient, right?
Yeah.
Just
then away from some source of heat.
Yeah.
The further
away you go,
the lower
temperature is. Just in general. It's like a wrench. Yeah,
also a wrench. Yeah. Did that answer the question? Or? So I think that temperature there is just the temperature at the frame. It's not like anywhere in the space.
Any other questions? Yeah, I'm buying my time. I have a little bit more material, but
you're going to give us lots of detail now, or you're
yeah, I'm going to give. So yeah, not for this one, but I'm going to give some detail about the Hawking radiation.
Oh, okay.
Oh, do you want details for this?
Well, okay. I thought, yeah, I'm not sure that Anton. Well, is Anton happy or?
Not yet.
Not yet. Yeah, you want more detail.
So. What radiation is displaced now, the radiation in the box or the radiation from the black hole?
From the box.
The box.
Okay. So I haven't looked at it in a long time, but I thought it was actually, I think that there's a sort of an atmosphere or cloud of Hawking radiation.
Mm-hmm.
And that the box is
the box goes in. Yeah.
So the box is displacing that radiation that would have been there.
Yeah, I mean, I'm assuming that the box is somehow not penetrable.
Right, yeah.
I mean, it's an imaginary box. but not imaginary in the mathematical sense.
It was imaginary.
Yeah, I mean, so this is like a box, like you're taking a brick and putting it in water, and you're displacing the water. So you can think of it this way. So this is also like pressures in water.
Right, but when you're saying displaced radiation, do you mean that within the box some of the radiation will move from the bottom to the top, and from the gravitational gradient that's going to be as much energy as the box weighs?
So I'll give you the example of you take a box and put it in water. This is exactly the same, but you will have a buoyancy force that in swamp. So this is equivalent to just talking about hydrodynamics. Oh, hydrostatics.
But what do you mean by displaced?
No, you don't have to worry about what is in the box. You can think of it as a brick. And what he's saying is that there's an atmosphere of radiation around the black hole, the Hawking radiation. And so by putting the brick there, you're displacing some of those photons or gravitons. Yeah.
I mean, this is a poor picture.
Well, how do you know that there's enough Hawking radiation to weigh as much as a box at any point outside the horizon?
That's a calculation he's not doing for.
Yeah. No, this is a calculation that I read, and I have to agree that I didn't fully understand it. So I kind of, this is how much I understood from the calculation. I should have probably paid a bit more detail to attention to it, but I was convinced by this very heuristic argument.
But part of that energy where did it go? I mean, that energy is like this energy here that he's calculating. Here he was talking about a point-like particle, but you can think it had some extent. So that energy is both the rest mass energy and the binding or potential energy, and so it's actually going to zero as you approach the horizon. So you could imagine that.
I mean, this is still applicable.
Yeah.
It's just that you get that correction from the radiation. And actually, this correction is what's necessary.
So the energy of the box is like the So it's a brick, not a box with gas in it.
No. Yeah, I mean, this is like a box of entropy, but it's kind of, it's not penetrable in some way. This is like an imaginary box. It's not something physical that you could do ever.
But it's
not something physical you could ever do in this kind of stuff as well.
But its energy includes the vibrations of the atoms inside it.
I have to say, I didn't think of it this way. You could think of it as a possibly extended object that has no internal structure. It just has the rest mass. So I don't know how to say it differently. I mean, this is not very physical. If you think about it in this kind of arguments, this would be a particle dropped onto a black hole. But it could be extended. And I need entropy in it.
Yeah.
So
you want some structure.
So it's that in this way, this is not a feasible thing to do. Maybe you could do the calculation in terms of a real, set of atoms.
Do you have the reference where you maybe spent on
it? I could point you out to it. I don't have it written here, but I have it in the other room, so I can point you to it after the lecture. Where was I? This is getting a bit hand wavy. But this will be more concrete now, but not very much more. So we'll try to understand Hawking radiation now in the last 15 minutes, and I don't know how well it's going to go. So I didn't time myself very well. So consider a Schwarzschild black hole. So we can write its metric as minus F e squared plus d r squared over F plus r squared e omega squared. And I'll just rewrite it in different form. This is a mere horizon. Just write in a second what these all of these transformations are. So x squared d eta squared plus d r squared plus blah blah blah. And finally I get to something that looks like Minkowski space. It's actually going to be a Rendler space. And we're going to be interested in this bit here. So F is the usual F. R is, as a function of R, is R minus 2gn plus, so this is infinitely many terms. This one is going to be the one we're interested in. And this is basically doing the similar calculation I was doing for the temperature of black holes. Kappa is 1 over 4 think GM is upstairs. Might be wrong though. It could be upstairs. And eta is kappa t. Capital T is R sinh eta. Capital Z is R cos eta. So what this is a regular space. Yeah.
But and then the two sphere, you change it to Cartesian coordinates.
I don't have to. I just wrote it.
Okay, but it's a two sphere.
Yeah. But I mean you can write it as dy squared, but it's it. So I think you can when you do this kind of thing. Written down the x and y.
I mean, somewhere along the way, you're focusing very closely.
Yeah, I'm mostly focusing on the near horizon.
Right. So if you focus on a small patch of the horizon, it also, even though it's a sphere, locally it looks like a flat.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't have to worry.
And this is all for Hawking radiation, so this is going to be close to the black hole and so on. So this is going to be T, this is going to be Z, this is small r equals to 2 gm, eta equals plus infinity. Eta is the conformal time, this is again r equals to 2 gm, eta equals minus infinity. So, and these coordinates, these kind of lines are lines of fixed eta. And these kind of lines are fixed r. So, this is getting cramped. But I'll call the left part of the z-axis L, the right part R. Also, this is getting very bad. This is region 1, this is region 2, region 3, and 4. And maybe I should have used color chart. Okay, so we have four separate regions of our space-time, and the key point now is that if you're in region 1, I mean, you're basically an accelerated observer, then you cannot communicate with regions 2 and 3, and the region 4 is just going to be giving you initial data. So at t equals 0, z less than 0 and degrees of freedom are irrelevant to region 1. So if we're doing some calculations, we'll just be tracing over these degrees of freedom. And now this is going to be some claim that I'll be proving. And this will be a proof For more details, I can give some more details if people are not satisfied. I'm guessing by how this was going so far, people will not be satisfied. Placing over L. This is going to be the ground state. This is going to be 1 over a set. E to minus 2 pi h r. Where hr is d by, I think of it as d by theta, or more explicitly, this is an integral over constant t surface of t a b by d eta a n b. This is normal to the surface. And if you want some more details, there's this very nice small book that has some more details by Susskind. So if someone wants, you can pick it up now. It's not mine, it's from the library. But, it has some more discussion about this. In a very very small format, easily readable, and Z is trace of over R e to minus 2 pi h r.
So like that's a different Z than your coordinate.
Sorry? I'll put my Z without this bar. And this is the partition function. So maybe I'll call it ZR. Yeah, that's also bad. I'm actually using R for two different things as well. But this is the partition function.
And that's so bad.
Which
sub R has a partition function set in it?
This one?
Yeah.
But I shouldn't call it R because we're tracing over R, so I can keep it like this. I'll try to condense this. We need this? Oh, maybe. I'll try to finish in a few minutes. If you really didn't like the lecture so far, you're free to leave. So, this density matrix that we're getting there, it is not a pure state. But it's entangled with the left degrees of freedom that we got rid of. So it's a thermal density matrix with temperature. So this will be a sort of proof. And the proof is by Milanero. So consider a scalar field. So at t equals 0, so this is getting bad. But my t is the coordinate here, and not the temperature. So I'll keep my temperatures with some subscripts. so that you know what was what. But I understand this is getting to be a very bad notation. I probably should have used some chi or whatever. So at coordinates t equals 0, there is a complete set of commuting degrees of freedom such that pi of x, y, z is equal to pi r of x, y, z. Z is greater than 0. This is the z coordinate. These are like the old x, y, z coordinates. Or pi left. They are commuting because there is space like separated. So any wave functional of phi or a scalar field can be written as psi of phi L phi R. And we're going to work all of this in Euclidean time. So the path integral representation of this of a ground state wave functional is psi ground state of IR equals 1 over square root of 2, not 2, and then square root of ZR, so the partition function. So the path integral defined. There is the condition that pi of x, x 0 equals 0 equals pi L e minus s Euclidean pi. We can write it as a path integral, and this is at constant x 0 minus I t slices. So we can see this more, we'll be able to see what's going on more clearly in constant Euclidean, because this is done at constant x zero slices. But we'll be able to see it better if you go to constant Euclidean Rindler time slices. So time theta equals minus I theta. So what we'll be doing is graphically, this was x 0 minus I t. This is z coordinate. L, R, and previously we were integrating over this, and now we'll be integrating over this kind of things, where this is theta equal minus I theta, and R goes in this direction. So theta is angular coordinate. I'm getting to the end, so yeah, you gave me maybe 5 more minutes. So we can write, so this is an angular coordinate in the x naught z plane. We can write the ground state wave functional as zero. We're requiring some regularity of the origin, so I'll just write that dr of phi at the origin is 0. So we have phi e times s e phi. So this. And I'll show it in a second, is 1 over root of z pi l e to minus pi h r pi r. And the reason for this is that if we're doing an integral over some first wedge from theta equals 0 to theta equals some small angle, then that will define a transfer matrix in the Hilbert space of phi r. And the matrix is going to be g equals identity minus I minus delta theta h r. And now the point is that we're going to integrate over many such slices. So we'll be raising g to power pi over delta theta. This is going to give us this. And I'm skipping some details now, but I want to get to the result. So, and yeah, if you want some more details, I'll have it in this book. We can discuss it afterwards. So it follows that if we take phi r, rho r, phi r prime, this is going to be d phi sine phi r sine phi.
Variational method?
Not really.
Nevertheless,
okay. we can talk after.
Yeah, I'm just going to.
We can talk afterwards. Maybe I should stop and then say something. Like just two more lines, I'll say something, then we can discuss. So this kind of proves the statement that the statement of the claim I gave there. Obviously, it's not very explicit. I mean, I kind of didn't show you this calculation. But I have a paper that does this calculation explicitly, so I can show it to you. So a few comments. I'll just make comments and not write anything. So maybe I'll write just the expression. So an accelerated observer here will see under radiation with temperature T equal A H bar over 2 pi. So by equivalence principle, this means that for a black hole, we're going to have dBH equals h bar kappa over 2 pi. And this is just proving.
So where do you introduce the?
Sorry? So A is going to be the acceleration of the.
Yeah, that's
so, so
the, from the start.
So, okay, so A.
Consideration where the.
This is R. If I'm not mistaken. Yeah, I never said anything about the acceleration, but.
R was a coordinate, right?
Yeah. So, this kind of coordinate, sorry.
I thought the acceleration is a constant, right?
These are fixed R. So, and these trajectories are at fixed R. So, and this kind of coordinates, what it means that, you kind of. The bigger the arc, the bigger the acceleration is. So when you're close to here, you're going to have small acceleration. And
no, it's the other way around.
Oh, is it?
Yeah.
Okay, it's the other way around. Yeah, so this is smaller, this is bigger.
No, what I meant was that the closer you get to the null surface,
yeah,
the faster the acceleration.
Yeah.
Oh.
So I tried to correct myself in this way.
Oh, okay.
I'm confusing people.
Okay.
A is probably one of the.
Sorry?
Yeah. A is probably one of the.
Quite possibly.
Like you said that the lines farther out were smaller, but that's not
yeah.
true. Because that.
Yeah, you meant smaller acceleration.
Yeah, smaller acceleration, but also larger.
Yeah.
Yeah, but that's related to the surface gravity. So there's a few other statements I could say, but I mean, this is basically you just apply equivalence principle from just going to from accelerated observers through gravitational effects. I mean, I could say something about the source of radiation and so on, but I think everyone knows how what the source of radiation for what that is. Yeah, this was a huge mess. Sorry.
Well, let's thank Andrew and